Let's get government operations started here. We don't have a quorum. We'll call it to order, officially to order when we have a quorum. Representative Sawatsky. First bill on the day is House File 2214. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'll move that House File 2214 be recommended to pass, or recommended to be referred, get my language right here, to the Transportation Finance Committee. Representative Sawatsky, please present your bill.
All right. Thank you for, I'm Mary Sawatsky, and thank you for hearing House File 2214. I bring this to you from MnDOT, the MnDOT agency. It's a housekeeping bill, and I have Eric Rudin here to walk through the pieces that you need to hear about.
And members, I believe it's Section 17. The expiration of an advisory council is why it's here before us. Mr. Rudin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Rudin from Department of Transportation, Government Affairs. The section that you referred to, Section 17 of the bill, extends the Non-Motorized Transportation Advisory Committee by another 4 years. This committee is set to expire currently on June 30th of this year. But MnDOT and others who serve on this committee find it valuable in seeking advice on issues related to non-motorized transportation, like bicycle and pedestrian issues. So this committee serves as a central coordinating and advisory body to developing bicycling goals, objectives, policies, and standards, and in order to better serve the non-motorized users of the state's transportation system, the committee advises and makes recommendations to the commissioner of the Department of Transportation. So again, we're just asking that it be extended for another 4 years.
And members, we now have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. And again, any questions of the testifier? Questions on the bill? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually haven't had much time to look at this. Could you just talk a little bit more? Could you just give a little bit more detail in some of the sections?
Certainly. Would you like me to walk through the entire bill?
I would, if you wouldn't okay. If you wouldn't mind. I know we're just looking at one section, but it's hard to ask questions on a section when you don't really know what the whole bill is.
Sure.
Mr. Rudin.
So, Mr. Chair, Section 1 of the bill amends Chapter 16A. It defines what an invoice means for receipt on a construction project, so that we have some clarity about when invoices are due. It also specifies that interest penalties do not accrue under Section 16A on construction projects. There are other provisions in trunk highway construction statutes where interest penalties could accrue if appropriate. Section 2 of the bill changes what's referred to as a cure period. Currently, there's a 60-day window if a contractor is not performing and is removed from work on a contract. Currently, we have to wait 60 days, but we're proposing instead that the contract would have that date spelled out, probably would be 15 days. Section 3 amends a provision that was enacted last year that requires the department to periodically review all of the property under control of the Department of Transportation and to sell or otherwise dispose of property that is no longer needed for transportation purposes. There was a restriction put in last year that if there's a potential bike or pedestrian use for that property, that then MnDOT could not get rid of the property. And so what we're proposing here is that if there's a restriction put into place that would preserve that bike ped use for the property, we'd be able to give it to a city or to sell it to a private entity so long as the bike ped use is preserved. Sections 4 and 6 of the bill relate to payments to cities and counties for their state aid funds. Currently, those are done in January, but we feel that they could be done earlier in the year to in the fiscal year to help cities and counties with their budgeting. Section 5 is a provision that was put in by the Association of Townships related to levies for road and bridge purposes. This is actually just cleanup from something that was done last year. Last year, the legislature struck a requirement that a township levy for road and bridge purposes in order to receive funding from the state for transportation purposes. Sections 7 and 8 of the bill reflect an agreement between townships and counties for when a bridge inspection finds an issue on a township bridge. There was some confusion about what the responsibility or duty of a county was, and counties are responsible for inspecting these township bridges, but then the question was, if an inspection finds something wrong, what should be done? And so this language was worked out and agreed to between the counties and the townships. Sections 9 and 10 talk about vehicle movements at intersections and when making a U-turn. The department has begun installing what we refer to as reduced conflict intersections, where if you're at a four-lane expressway and trying to go across that expressway or make a left turn, rather than go directly across, you are required to make a right-hand turn, go down a short distance, and then make a U-turn to come back. And there are vehicles such as semis that cannot make a U-turn into the closest lane. So this language clarifies that if you're driving a vehicle that cannot make that movement into the closest lane, you can go on to the right lane or the shoulder if necessary. There are several sections in the bill that update state statute to bring it into conformity with federal law for covered farm vehicles. I won't go through those in detail unless you'd like me to do so, but the new federal transportation bill, which is referred to as MAP 21, made several changes in these areas, and so we're updating the state statutes to reflect those changes. And so that would be sections 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Then section 16 amends language for the Transportation Economic Development Program. There have been two appropriations for this program, and one appropriation was made available until expended and the other was not, and so we're just proposing that all funds in that program be available until expended. Section 17 we addressed already. That's the extension of the Non-Motorized Transportation Advisory Committee. Section 18 again and 19 are both changes for the covered farm vehicles. Section 20, 21, 22, and 23 relate to a project at the Rochester MnDOT facility. What we're doing there is shifting some money between the two phases of the project. The first phase came in a little bit under budget, and the second phase is slightly over what was originally appropriated, so it's a net $0 impact, but we're just shifting the funding between the two phases of the project. Section 24 of the bill corrects an earlier cancellation for trunk highway projects that was in response to some flooding, and a previous cancellation overstated the cancellation, and so we're just making that correction. Section 25 of the bill amends something that was enacted last year for turning back jurisdiction of Highway 66 in Blue Earth County. And the original plan last year was to give the entire portion of the highway to the county, and then the county was going to turn over that portion within the city of Mankato to the city. But since then, the city has asked that the portion within the city be turned over directly to them. So that's what that change does. And then Section 26A repeals legislative jurisdiction of a highway at the former Brainerd State Hospital, and then that will be given over to Department of Administration. And Section 26B is a repealer related to the agricultural vehicles that were discussed earlier.
So, members, again, the part that pertains to us is Section 17. Any questions, Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for either I just, if you could talk a little bit more about the Advisory Committee on Non-Motorized Transportation. You extend the sunset 4 years. Is there additional cost to doing that? Maybe you can talk about the size of that. And then is the intention to keep going forward, or is the intention to, you know, is it to, the intention to eventually make this permanent, or is 2018 going to be the last year for it?
Mr. Radin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I believe there are about 15 members on the committee. I think that about half the committee is made up by representatives from state agencies, I think Department of Education, Department of Health, and I think the Met Council has a member. The other half are public appointees from various regions of the state, all over the state. There's a small cost. I think it's about $6,000 per year for paying for travel expenses for those members from Greater Minnesota. And so, you know, that's something that is a current expense that would be continued. And as far as whether it would be permanent or not, I guess, you know, that would remain to be seen. The department feels that it's currently providing a valuable service, and so we would like to see it extended at least another 4 years, and then we would have to reevaluate at that time whether it should be continued beyond that. So we're not proposing to make it permanent, but there's also no specific task that they're working on that would be finished necessarily in 4 years.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to recognize students from St. Louis Park High School, and I'm not sure if the committee DFL researcher would like to say a few words on their behalf or not, but and her father is still the chair of the St. Louis Park School Board. But welcome to all of you, and I'd like to thank the members of the committee for demonstrating just sort of the degree of boringness that we could get to in a bill and follow-up questions. No. It's not always like this. We can do much better, and I'm sorry you came in for this particular bill, but
sometimes I'm boring?
We generate real excitement here. So welcome, and thank you for coming.
Yeah. I won't forget that, Representative Winkler.
Representative Pepin, you had a follow-up.
Chairman, just a point of personal privilege.
Representative Kahn.
Someone needs to apologize to Representative Swatsky. I've never seen someone more insulted in a committee in front of a crowd. So,
Representative Pepin, did you have a follow-up?
No, I think the comment was more for me than for Representative Swatsky. If I know Representative Winkler well enough, I'll pass.
And Representative Kahn, this is an agency bill, and it's basically a cleanup type bill. It's most of those are pretty boring. Any other further questions? Anybody from the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not,
a senior member has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
No, just a comment to the person who's accompanying Representative Swatsky. I think he can testify that I've done a pretty good job of giving him fairly interesting department issues. So,
and he's shaking his head yes. Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2214 be referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill's referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
The next bill we have on our agenda today is House File 2523, Representative Joanne Ward. Welcome to the committee. And I'll move that House File 2523 be placed on the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee, and staff. We have another cleanup bill here, so it's not going to be full of really interesting things, but important work.
So, Representative Ward, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill updates and clarifies Chapter 145A and the Local Public Health Act. Chapter 145A provides the foundation and organizing framework for Minnesota's local public health system, which together with Minnesota Department of Health ensures that the public's health and safety are protected across the state. When the law was passed in 1976, there were over 2,000 local boards of health with overlapping jurisdictions and no way to communicate or coordinate with each other or the State Department of Health. Most public health issues don't stop at county lines or city boundaries, so it's very important to have an organized and statewide approach. House File 2523 keeps what has worked well in the current law and addresses parts that are confusing or out of date without changing or diminishing local authorities. Because the 1976 statute was added onto an even older legacy language, likely written in the 1940s, a number of topics were addressed in two different parts of the statute. Examples include the formation, organization, and powers and duties for boards of health and community health boards, and the powers and duties of the Commission of Health. The bill also updates the statute so that it aligns with current practice. For example, it highlights performance measures and continuous improvements, which are used to maximize effective use of the resources. The proposed changes were developed by the Minnesota Department of Health in partnership with local government representatives and are supported by the stakeholder groups that are affected. I think you have a list of those stakeholders. Deborah Burns from the Minnesota Department of Health is here to explain in more detail.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Deb Burns, the Director of the Office of Performance Improvement at the Minnesota Department of Health. As Representative Ward mentioned, 145A is the foundational statute for our state and local public health system in Minnesota. It creates the local public health system that the State Health Department works in partnership with. House File 2523 was developed by a work group of the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee, which is a statutorily defined advisory body to the Commissioner of Health that has one representative from each of the 50 community health boards in the state. As Representative Ward mentioned, it keeps a lot of the current statute because it's working very well, but it was an opportunity to clean up and update the language so it reflects kind of the current public health practice. A lot has changed in the years since 1976. And it also makes the statute easier to understand. The responsibilities and duties of either the commissioner or local governments aren't substantially expanded or diminished. There are a couple of new sections that I can highlight if you would like.
That would be good.
Okay. Really, sections 1 through 8 are adding definitions. Again, those of terms that are currently reflected in public health practice in Minnesota. 9 through 13, those sections are primarily cleaning up and deduplicating. It removes an old term, local board of health, and replaces it with community health board, which is the current structure for local public health in Minnesota. Section 14, the duties were rewritten to make the local responsibilities more clear because there was confusion because there were two parts of the statute that had duties for local governments. And one additional responsibility was added, which is to implement a performance management process to assure continuous improvement. In Section 20, there's a parallel requirement for the Commissioner of Health to attend to system-wide or statewide level performance management. That's a parallel duty to that. And then in Section 27, the accountability language for community health boards, which is local public health, was also rewritten and simplified, and an appeals process was added. So while this act was quite revolutionary when it was drafted in 1976, it really was, we view these changes as evolutionary, and they are supported by the Local Public Health Association. This advisory committee adopted and approved them. The Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and the Minnesota Public Health Association are all in support.
Thank you. Members, any questions of the author or the testifier? Representative Pepper.
Thanks. I'm just wondering if you could comment briefly on, looks like it's section 27, the accountability, the whole accountability section, where there's a lot of crossed off text mm-hmm. and then some added text. If you could just kind of briefly explain what that does.
Sure.
Ms. Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives. This section, it's consolidated and shortened to a great extent. The process for the accountability was quite lengthy, and one of our goals was to really shorten and simplify this. It keeps strong accountabilities in place. So it doesn't change that level of accountability, but it shortens and simplifies it, and then it adds an appeals process for local governments if they disagree with the commissioner's recommendations.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Burns. Also just had a question on, I guess, page 1 and page 2, the areas of public health responsibility, line 1.17. One of the areas is promoting healthy communities and healthy behaviors. And then there's a reference on page 2.25, the 10 essential public health services are to diagnose and investigate health problems and health hazards in the community. Can you talk a little bit more about what those two sections are getting at, what they mean?
Absolutely.
Ms. Burns.
Mr. Chair, representatives, the areas of public health responsibility have been used to describe the kind of the what of public health. What are the areas that the public health system works in? They were derived from national work, and they've been used in Minnesota since 2004. It's how the local health departments kind of how we categorize the work under these major responsibilities and how they report back to the Minnesota Department of Health on their work. So really, those represent the kind of the what. On the next page, the other section you asked about, the essential public health services are more the how. It's how do state and local public health agencies do their work. We do it by monitoring health status, diagnosing and investigating health problems.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Burns. On, again, the first part, so promoting healthy communities and healthy behaviors, I guess I'm curious as to what exactly that means. Does that mean you promote maybe walking programs in cities, or does it have anything to do with smoking, or do you get involved in e-cigarettes? What does that mean?
Ms. Burns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. It's a very broad category. It includes some of the maternal and child health things that are done to promote healthy mothers and healthy children. It also would include things like public health activities related to tobacco and a number of other public health issues that affect the public's health. It's a very broad statement.
Any further questions? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, does that same line, 1.17, refer to any in-home visits, anything like that?
Ms. Burns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, this is a way to kind of categorize the work of public health, and so for example, home visiting could be included under that.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that is this category. Is there anything subsequent in the bill that further clarifies what that would look like, the potential home visits?
Ms. Burns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, there is nothing specific to home visits in the Act. There are definitions that give examples of each of these six areas included in the definition section.
And where would that be, if you could point me to that, please?
Ms. Burns?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, page 6 gives examples. starting with line 6.8 and ending at the top of page 7 on line 7.3. So these are examples of the kinds of activities that a health department would carry out or could carry out under that area of responsibility.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am wondering if, you know, I haven't read all of that verbiage, wondering if there is an expanded, directive or accommodation for home visits relative to what the statute reflected in the past.
Ms. Burns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, this does not expand the duties or responsibilities. These have been used for about 10 years, these definitions, and are just being reflected in statute now.
Thank you.
Representative Pugh, any further questions? Anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill?
I know.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And the I guess what I would like to point out about the bill is if you look at Section 1, Subdivision A, the areas of public health responsibility, and you look at Section 5, the essential public health services, and then you combine that with the duties that, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but the woman who was just testifying was talking about on line 6.8 through 7.3. Our concern here is, of course, when you know, one of the things that she said was, this is what we've been using, we're just now codifying it into statute. Well, statute actually means something, because it is the power of government. And so when you put it into law, it's a requirement. It's different than if a department just decides, well, we're going to do this sort of thing. It may or may not be looked at as actually authorized. But now this would be authorizing all of these very broad duties, making them statutorily legal, even if a community or the individuals in a community might disagree. And so if you look at 1.16, which is assuring an adequate local public health infrastructure, and then you go to line 2.24, which is monitoring health status to identify and solve community health problems, diagnosing and investigating health problems in the community. And then you go beyond that to line 6.8 with the public health infrastructure, which includes data analysis and utilization. It includes policy development, analysis and decision support, communication, public health research, evaluation and quality improvement. What we're really talking about here is the ability of a local public health board to do significant data collection and research, perhaps even down to the individual, perhaps what their diagnoses are, perhaps where they live versus their diagnoses. We're uncertain, but it is, as the previous testifier said, it is very broad authority, and it means something to put it into statute as opposed to just having it out there as something that they might do. Then the last thing I would say is it particularly means something because there are performance measures. Performance measures is the state actually telling the local community health boards more what they have to do. And so if this becomes intrusive, for instance, into the community and to individuals in the community, the state will be monitoring their performance in doing these things that now become statutory. So our concern is that we are moving into a much bigger reach of the state government into the communities through making the statutory language.
Thank you. Questions of the testifier? Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Chair. Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Braze, so the The data analysis and utilization mentioned on 6.9, 6.10, you mentioned data collection. Do we know for sure that these boards will be doing actual data collection as well, or will it simply be analysis and utilization of what they analyze?
Ms. Brace.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, because there are not definitions for some of the words in here, the possibility exists that they can. So when it says on line 2.24, monitor health status, well, it's difficult to monitor health status without data, so somebody has to collect the data, whether it's the health board or whether it's them getting it from somebody else who has the data. It's impossible to monitor health status without having something to monitor. And then where it talks about analysis on line 6.110, it includes data analysis and utilization. So I don't know how you will monitor health status without having data collected from somewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Braze. Do we know, Mr. Chair, has this bill gone to civil law yet?
As I see here, no. This was vetted in Health and Human Services policy, and most of these issues are dealing with Health and Human Services policy that she's talking about. But as far as the instructions I have, is it going to the General Register?
Mr. Chair, the questions around data and collection of information certainly is a civil law purview. Does it make sense to send it there?
Representative Drazkowski, they have not asked for it, as that I'm aware of, and if they, and it gets to the floor, if they want to have it re-referred, they can do that from the floor. I'm going to send it where I'm told to send it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Braze, do you think that there are sufficient data privacy issues that it should be fully vetted in civil law? Because there's a chance that they just didn't realize of the, it's a large bill, and there's a chance that it didn't really ring a bell when they looked at it before. I'm just curious of your opinion on that.
Ms. Brace.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, bills have been flying fast and furiously at this stage, and this is a short session. I would say that this has significant data concerns. It should go through civil law, and it is possible that they just did not notice it, thinking it was just a public health bill and not really noticing the data pieces of it. We would prefer to go to civil law.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my guess is that someone will make the motion on the floor, and maybe to save Representative Sawatsky some headaches. I'm not sure how this works with the policy deadline. I'm not how that works, but it does seem like there are some issues here.
I believe it's Representative Ward who's presenting this bill.
Sorry,
I know.
I'm sorry, Representative Ward. And she's been in here about 3 days in a row.
Representative Pepin, I think if I understand that the Civil Law Committee is meeting later in the week, so I might just as well send it to them. So. Mm-hmm. I'll do that. That makes it easy. Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, I guess I just don't think we should have motions to send to committees when the committee hasn't asked for it based on sort of random comments from committee members and a member of the public. I mean, if the Civil Law Committee doesn't feel like it needs to hear the bill, I don't know why we would send it to them. So I would oppose the amendment to the motion.
Representative Winkler, they may not have seen it, and I think just to be safe, that way, if it needs to get heard there, if they don't need to hear it, they can just move it to the floor with a short hearing. And Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I consider civil law and GovOps to be the two banes of my existence, serving on both committees. And I guess maybe the challenge would be that any committee member who would like to send this to civil law should point out where in the bill the Data Practices Act is referenced.
Representative Pepin.
Because otherwise it doesn't belong there.
Representative Pepin.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Braze has pointed out lots of areas. There's very broad definitions here, and as she pointed out in her testimony, that in order to be able to carry out these functions, there will have to be a lot of data collected. I don't think there needs to be a reference to data privacy for the committee to hear the bill. Mr. Chair, it doesn't matter to me. It just seems like to save time in a house floor fight, Representative Ward has an opinion that maybe she would rather not fight on the house floor about it and would rather just
Representative Pippen, I'm going to amend my motion and send it to the civil law. It's better to be safe than sorry. It's similar to bills that have questionable fiscal impact. It's safer to send them to a fiscal committee and instead of having them not meet deadlines and have to go to rules. So I think I'm going to do that just to cut the discussion down. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will point out that I do have several questions that I'm now not going to ask, such as investing in healthy families. I think that's information that really does need to be vetted more, but I don't think this is the proper place for it. So thank you for that.
Well, Representative Pepin, that would be a health committee. I believe those questions were asked and vetted in the health committee.
But not the data part of it.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, there is nothing in this bill that references the Data Practices Act. That is the purview of the Civil Law Committee. Civil Law Committee jurisdiction was already expanded this legislative term by rule to require that any bill dealing with the Data Practices Act would have to go through the Civil Law Committee. There's nothing in this bill. And just because people want to talk about that issue in this committee does not mean that that committee has purview over the bill. So I think it is a mistake, and it's just repetitive committee work that has no function in order to accommodate a fairly unreasonable request from the minority. So I think it's unjustified, and it's simply expanding the amount of time we're spending on something without doing any more valuable work.
Representative Winkler, duly noted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
If it would be helpful, I will have a conversation with the committee chair in civil law and ask if they would like to review this before we go to the floor. I don't know the process. What's the best way to do that?
Representative Ward, if I send it to the floor, it'll take longer and it might miss deadlines. If we send it there, it'll get referred to them, and then they can, any process, they can have a quick hearing there and pass it out and move it to the floor.
Okay.
I just would rather not miss deadlines and spend the rest of our time here arguing about whether it should go there or not. So,
thank you.
Any further questions of the testifier? Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? If not, I'll amend my motion that House File 2523 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill's re-referred.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your help.
The next bill on our agenda is House File 2664.
Hello, Representative Nelson. Would you like to explain the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2664 be placed on the General Register. And members, again, this is one of the series of unsessioned bills that are coming forward. This one has to do with Minute, and I have Mr. Eichten here from the Minute to explain the bill and go through it, but it's basically... It's not a lot of changes. They're a fairly new agency, so there are not a lot of changes that have to go to the bill. But I'll hand it over to Mr. Eichten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name, for the record, John Eichten, Legislative Liaison for Minute Services. What you have before you are Minute's proposed unsession revisions. These are technical changes largely designed to eliminate unnecessary language, make conforming changes to 16E in light of IT consolidation. The bill also eliminates some redundant powers that appear in Minute statutes, clarifies Minute's jurisdiction within the executive branch. I should also point out the bill contains a repealer that strikes some references to outdated task forces, also strikes some obsolete language requiring the Department of Administration to provide administrative support to Minute. Language providing authority for joint actions, that appears again verbatim later in the statute. And then the last repealer is the section on the Advisory Committee for Technology Standards for Accessibility and Usability. This is a group that sunset actually in June 30th, 2013. So it can be removed from the statute, but I should point out the group is now part of Minute's internal governance structure. The same members came over. This was an effort to bring them closer to the decision-making process around IT so that their advice could really be brought into, as I said, the decision-making process. So it is being taken out of statute, but it continues as part of the internal governance structure. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Are there any questions? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for either Representative Nelson or Mr. Eichten. I'm just wondering if this bill saves the state any money or if it repeals or eliminates any active boards, commissions, or agencies.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Pepin, the bill does not save any money. It doesn't eliminate from practice any active boards or commissions, and all it does is strike language from statute that created this committee, and the language in statute sunset in last year at the end of June. So the group will continue, but with the support, I should say, of the accessibility, disability, community advocates, they've told us if it doesn't work out being part of the internal governance structure, they'll likely come back to the legislature and ask for this group to be put back in statute.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Eichten, thank you for that explanation. I ask that about every on-session bill because I'm curious as to exactly what it all means and what the state benefit is. Could you, you might have mentioned this briefly, could you go to subdivision 8, starting on line 7.9, and it's exemptions, and it says 16C.06, subdivision 3B, and I didn't get a chance to. Maybe that's on the back here. Could you just talk about that while I review that section, too?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I failed to point that out. That is a change that was made, I believe, by the reviser. It's to conform with the Department of Administration on-session bill, which is moving around some renumbering some subdivisions.
Representative Pepin?
I don't think I have it in my appendix here, which is usually included. Could Mr. Shepherd or Ms. Dyson, I'm not sure who's on it, explain to me what exactly that is? That was a little vague.
His microphone.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, you were asking about the striking of the reference to Section 16C.03, Subdivision 17. Mm-hmm. That section is not being repealed here, but just the reference mm-hmm. to it is being stricken, and that currently says that the term of a contract can be extended for a time up to 10 years if the Commissioner of Administration determines certain things occur. And I believe what Mr. Eichten testified is that there's another bill, that the Department of Administration bill that this committee heard earlier, that was moving some things around in Chapter 16B and 16C that is changing that cross-reference. And so Mr. Eichten indicated the reviser suggested apparently striking this because it won't be the proper reference if the other bill passes.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. If the bill passes, what if the bill doesn't pass? The other bill.
Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, if the other bill doesn't pass and this one did, then this reference would no longer be in statute anymore. So there would, because it's an exemption, it says the state information network is exempt from the 5 and 10 year limit on contracts. If the other bill didn't pass, I don't think it would have a substantive impact on Minute's operations because it would be exempt from. It's still exempt. It just wouldn't have the correct cross reference in the statute anymore. Is my sense of it off the top of my head.
Representative Kahn.
There are two things which just may be minor, and I'm sorry if you said it and I missed them, but that's the deleted language on 611 to 614 and the the deleted language on 7.3 to 7.4. I don't know if we need to have this language in the statute, but it is something that we clearly wanted Minute to do, and I guess I want some kind of assurance that where do we know this is being done if we don't, and one of the things I've been most concerned about is what happened, and I think it was the Senate's fault, not the House's fault, with Minture. When Minute was removed, the Senate and then the conference committee removed Minute from a certain amount of oversight over it. And I don't know if it would have solved all the problems, but I sure didn't think it helped. So I just want to know about those two things that are being taken out.
Mr. Eichten.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, those two pieces of language, the first one, 611 to 614, we don't understand that to have any substantive effect on Minute's operations. It was just some vague language that we felt was redundant in light of the rest of the charge contained in 16E, and it's a little unclear, so we thought that could go. 7.3 to 7.4, to be frank, we just felt like that, again, was just unclear language. We weren't really clear what the meaning, you know, was of assistance of demonstration projects. If we wanted to do any kind of, you know, technology demonstration, we feel like it's still within the authority of Minute to do that, but this language was a bit vague and unclear for us.
No, I don't,
Representative Kahn,
exactly disagree. I just worry about what's happening if they're not there. So I guess we wait till someone complains that you're not doing those things and then say, why did we take it out? And we'll blame it on
Mr. Chair,
Representative Nelson. Okay.
That's right. Okay. That sounded like more of a comment. Are there any further questions? Representative Kahn?
The committee on the people who work to put in the technology standards for accessibility and usability are all okay with this deletion at this point?
Mr. Eichten?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, they are.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
And Representative Kahn, Mr. Chair, I also, when I saw this originally in there, I flagged that myself. Is it, you know, where is it being transferred to? Is it going away? And have they checked with Senator Westrom and other people in the community? And they said, yes, this, because it's going internal. It's just not going to be a separate task force. It's going to be part of their internal structure.
Okay.
And he was okay with that, was the message I got back.
Okay, great.
Are there further questions? Seeing none, Representative Nelson, would you like to renew your motion that House File 2664 be referred to the General Register?
That's my motion, Mr. Chair.
Would anyone from the audience like to speak for or against this bill? Okay. Seeing nobody, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 2664 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is referred. Representative Nelson, what is your pleasure? Which would you like to do, House File 2319 next?
Yes.
Okay. Sure.
Maybe we should, Mr. Chair, maybe we should send the page up to get Representative Paymar. He's got the next two. He's in room 10? Okay. Across the hall.
Okay.
And I believe there's some amendment to this. Yes.
Okay. Sure. There's an amendment in the packet, but my understanding is that's outdated, and there is a replacement amendment being handed out. Representative Nelson, would you like to begin your testimony while that occurs?
Mr. Chair, members, I'll move that House File 2319 be moved to the General Register, and if you could make sure I get the copy of the amendment also.
Sure.
And this is, members, Mr. Chair, this is a bill brought forth by the Met Council. It's having to do with how they invest their short-term money. Right now, the large counties in the metro area have this ability. The Met Council covers all those, and they're just asking to have the same investment authority. And with me is somebody from the Met Council here, and she can describe exactly what it does.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. If you could please say your name for the tape.
Thank you.
My name is Mary Bogie, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Metropolitan Council. And much like was said here, this bill simply gives the council the same investing tools that are available to large counties in the area. It will allow the council to manage its investments and manage its cash flow more efficiently and pick up a little bit of investment income in a time when there's not a lot out there to be earned. So it's simply an investment tool that we will use to manage the portfolio that the council has. The council does have an investment policy. The first priority of our investment policy is protect the principal. We also have an investment review committee. That committee meets 4 times a year, so on a quarterly basis. It has a couple of council members on it, and it also has 2 members from private industry. In that investment review committee, we review the results of our investment activity from the prior quarter, and we look to them for are there things that we should be doing different with our investment strategy, or are we on the right track with the council's investments? And so the council does have appropriate internal controls in place to manage its investment activity.
Thank you, Ms. Bogie. Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As it's no secret, when we get to certain regulated industries and financial services, I'm usually one that has a few questions. And I'd like to ask the testifier. She referred to an investment review board, and I'm wondering if they also have a separate investment advisor for the council as well.
Ms. Bogie.
Chair and members, we do have a financial advisor that we use on our bond issuances when we issue debt. We normally do not use an investment advisor except for our fuel hedging program. We do use an advisor in that case, but beyond that, we have our internal staff doing our investment activity.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what the testifier is referring to is that they maybe have bond counsel that helps them with some of these different kinds of underwriting issues. An investment advisor is someone who's different, who would make suggestions and recommendations on a portfolio and help them to time the purchases that they need to do with the investments that they're making to try to return some money on that. I'd just like to know a little bit more about your investment review. You said it was made up of council members. What kind of expertise do those individuals have in finance or in investment?
Ms. Bogie.
Mr. Chair, yes, we do have a bond counsel for our bond issuances, but we also have a financial advisor, and they help us both with our bond issues as well as if we're looking to do something new in the investment market, we would go to them as well. In terms of our investment review committee, 2 council members who have an interest, I would say, but not necessarily expertise in investing, and then 2 private industry members who have expertise in the field. One of our investment review committee members comes from the University of Minnesota, was in private industry, and is now teaching there. She recently moved on to a new position, and I'm having trouble remembering where she went to. The second one is from private industry, was in the investment field.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is the members that are on the council, I would suspect that it's based on kind of who's appointed and who's elected or who serves on the council as to the depth of their expertise on this. Do you have any, can you assure the committee as it relates to the expertise of those members or what you do to assure that? Is there some flexibility that if you don't have enough expertise or interest from council members, you can get other outside advisors or other outside interested parties who can provide counsel or suggestions to the Met Council?
Ms. Bogie.
Chair and members, yes, it definitely is dependent on who's been appointed to the council in terms of the level of expertise that they might have as they come into the investment review committee. And that's exactly the reason for us putting members from private industry on the investment review committee as well. If one of the council members were to say, you know what, I just don't really understand this stuff and I'm not the right fit for the investment review committee, definitely we would look to the chair to replace that member on the committee. But we are definitely relying on our outside members to bring in that expertise as well.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So help me when the investment review board gets together. Who chairs that? Who shares the information? Where is the information brought from for individuals to review and to share comments? And does this individual make recommendations to the review board as to what might be suitable investments?
Ms. Bogie?
Mr. Chair, the information that's brought to the investment review committee is prepared by my staff, my treasury director, and it contains information about the economy and how that impacts the council, what we've invested in terms of our short-term investments as well as our long-term investments. We talk about duration. We talk about how we compare to indices that are similar to us. The meeting is chaired by a council member of the investment review committee. We present both a paper report to the committee as well as we do a PowerPoint presentation of the highlights of the last quarter. And we talk to the investment review committee about what the story of the last quarter as well as where we're going to in the future and what they might see as some things that we should watch out for or some direction that we should be going towards. I will give an example of we were largely invested in U.S. agencies when the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac fiasco, we'll just call it, came about. And our investment review committee said to us, you know, maybe we'd want to back out of some of those and invest in something a little bit different, depending, you know, we fully expect that those things we hold to maturity, so we fully expect that those things will be okay. But let's take a little bit of risk out of there. So that's the kind of conversation that we would have in the investment review committee and the direction that they would give to my staff in terms of what we want our strategy to be.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As anyone that's providing advice to the Commission on investing of the public dollars, are they FINRA registered at all?
Ms. Bogie?
Mr. Chair, I am not sure of the answer to that, and I would need to check.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Just for clarification, I always ask other testifiers and I throw out industry jargon to explain what that means. FINRA is the entity that licenses people who are involved in the sale and advice on securities. And I'm just wondering if any of the people who are in that investment review or the persons who are providing information to the investment board have any kind of FINRA registration or securities license to be able to provide that information.
Ms. Bogie?
And Mr. Chair, I do not know whether they have that background. However, I will say that the Investment Review Committee is not giving us advice about particular securities to invest in, but our overall strategy.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then when they talk about the overall strategy, who makes the advice on which investments to be making or who is the entity that you purchase those from?
Ms. Bogie.
Mr. Chair and members, the council uses brokers who we work through. We have our own investment team of staff, and they are working with those brokers who we do an RFP with to bring them into our group. So we are working with a broker in terms of what it is we are buying.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few other questions on this particular item here. At the time that you approach the broker, does the broker make any comment about the type of investments that you are or make comments on the investment strategies or simply is an order taker at that point?
Ms. Bogie. Mr.
Chair and committee members, I would say that they are more of an order taker and that my staff is more of the doing the research on the investment.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Just a final word of advice to the committee. We have the Met Council, which is an unelected body that has members that are on here that are selected from the public and from within the council body that are receiving advice from potentially unregistered people. I would just put a word of caution on there that not that there's anything that's going wrong or is wrong. I'm just saying that we want to make sure that we're getting good, solid advice, I think, for the taxpayers, particularly in the seven-county metro area, because that's where the Met Council is, that we look to try to shore that up for the taxpayers, because there could be some issues at some point where something goes awry, where you have people who aren't registered or practitioners in the industry that are making decisions. And so I will just leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Before continuing, we would like to introduce the ninth graders from St. Louis Park High School. They are participating in the Capitol Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Educational Program. So thank you for coming. Okay. I do have three other people registered to testify here, too. I don't know if it's the will of the committee. We could take their testimony, and then if there are further questions, Ms. Bogie can return.
Mr. Chair, I believe they're on the amendment, and at this time I will move the amendment, the A2 amendment.
Okay.
And Ms. Dyson, I believe there's they have five word. This amendment has it? Okay. There was some added language the state auditor wanted in this amendment, and that reflects the A2 amendment. So okay. I guess. So I'll move the A2 amendment to be added to the bill.
Representative Nelson moves the A2 amendment to your amendment. Representative Nelson.
Yep.
Would you like to explain it? Puts it in the form you'd like?
It puts it in the form I like, and sure. I'm supposed to explain that portion of it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nelson has moved the A2 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities, and also working with the Minnesota School Boards Association. I'd like to thank Representative Nelson for allowing this A2 amendment to be offered. What it does is provide just some very limited additional investment authority for a select group of entities, investment pools that are run by cities, counties, and schools. It doesn't provide broad authority to all entities, just those more sophisticated investors. It allows for the investment in the highest grade commercial paper or certificates of deposit. And we've had ongoing discussions with the state auditor's office because they kind of pay attention to the kind of things that local governments can invest in. They have expressed no concern with this bill. We've just talked to Dave Kenny of their office this morning, and they are comfortable with it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Grundhofer. Are there any questions for Mr. Grundhofer? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Grundhofer. Trying to read and understand the context of this amendment, but I do understand that it applies not only to those cities of 200,000 or more in population, but under the bill also to the Metropolitan Council. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Grundhofer. Representative Druskowski, I think the bill only applies to those largest cities and to investment pools of schools, cities, and counties. It does not apply to the Metropolitan Council.
Mr. Chair, the original
Representative Nelson.
The amendment adds the cities, counties, and schools and their joint entities to join this. The original bill deals with the Met Council. So this is just adding these people into the original bill. It's similar, giving them similar authority, and that's why I accepted the amendment. It's from another bill that was being brought forward, and it was just easier to put them together in one.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Further questions for this testifier?
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Grundhofer, so we do say, we're giving authority to these schools and other organizations you talked about. I'm trying to remember exactly what they were, but to invest in a state branch of a foreign bank, is there a reason, a state-licensed branch of a foreign bank? Are we on the – I saw a shock in your response there, Mr. Grundhofer. We're on the A2 amendment?
Yep.
Is there a reason why we want to invest government money in a foreign bank rather than in U.S. banks?
Just quick clarification, the amendment has been adopted, Representative Druskowski. Mr. Grundhofer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, it is just a broad investment authority to the highest grade, banks in Minnesota or elsewhere. We haven't limited it to just Minnesota banks, correct, but they have to have a branch here in Minnesota in order for the foreign bank to be eligible.
Representative Drazkowski. Well,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe this question is for Representative Nelson. Mr. Chair, why do we, I mean, I would think the people of Minnesota would want to have our investments made in Minnesota banks, ideally, and U.S. banks secondarily, but to export more of our investments to foreign countries. Is that what your intention is?
Representative Chair Nelson. And Representative Drazkowski, this doesn't move our investment to a foreign bank. This is a state-licensed branch, so they would have to have a physical presence here in the state, and so we'd be investing in maybe securities that they offered, and it's not taking that money and moving it overseas into a investing in any place else.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. The removal of the need for collateralized requirements under 18A.03, is that, this is maybe more of a commerce question, but that's another place that kind of strikes me in the bill or in the amendment. Is there any comments on that, Mr. Grundhofer?
Mr. Grundhofer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, what we've done here is, again, when we talked to the state auditor's office, they were concerned about making sure that this kind of authority invested only applied to the, I'll call it, more sophisticated investors. What it does is basically treats uncollateralized deposits much like commercial paper. You can only invest in commercial paper in the highest grade commercial paper rated in the highest rating categories. Similarly, we could only invest in the uncollateralized CDs only in banks that are in the highest category of rating.
Thank you, Mr. Grundhofer.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to provide clarification on some terminology. It's been a long time since I've looked at the bank statutes, but my assumption is that they follow that of the insurance statutes, where foreign doesn't necessarily mean outside of the United States. Foreign means outside of the state. So if you refer to a bank that's domiciled or a domiciled license, you're talking about issued by the state of residency. So we could have a bank in Minnesota and one that's in Wisconsin. With a Wisconsin branch in Minnesota, under Minnesota banking law, if memory serves me right, they would be considered a foreign, not necessarily foreign as in non-U.S. based.
Thank you for the clarification, Representative O'Driscoll. Wisconsin is pretty foreign. I have two other testifiers on the list here. The next one is Tiffany Rodning. It's Tiffany Rodning here.
She doesn't need.
Okay, all right, thank you. Then after that is Don Hansen. Okay, so is there anyone else from the audience who would like to speak for or against this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'm sorry, yeah, to the bill. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure if it would be you or someone else that would answer the question. Since we're granting this additional authority, part of the problem is I don't know what the authority or how it works for the cities that have this already, specifically when it talks about the written investment policy. It says prior to exercising any additional authority, the governmental entity must have written investment policies. That says on a 2.11 and 2.12. And then it talks about an oversight process in 2.23, and it doesn't lay it out here to my knowledge, but it's obviously already done in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So how would one go about looking at the written investment policies? Is that published somewhere, or before you start doing this, how would I know? Can I go and look at it before you start doing this? And also the oversight process, how does that work? And is it talks about audit review, but I'm not sure who that, is it the state auditor, or who's the audit? Is that an internal thing? Just trying to figure out how that works. It obviously already exists elsewhere, but since we're expanding it to the Met Council, I want to know how it works here too.
Ms. Bogey.
I'll let Ms. Bogey answer the question.
Mr. Chair, for the Met Council already has an investment policy that we would add this type of investment to as well. Our current investment policy already requires us to have an investment review committee, and we talked about that a little bit earlier. We have a couple council members on there and two outside private industry members of that. So our investment review committee by policy meets quarterly, And so we review the investment activity from the prior quarter and anything that's occurring in the market, how the economy is impacting the council, those types of things with our investment review committee. That's laid out in our policy that we meet with them quarterly and review that activity. The council is audited by the Office of the State Auditor, and so as part of our financial and management audit, the investments are a piece of that audit. As well, the council has an internal audit staff, and periodically investment review would come up on their audit schedule as well. In terms of, is our policy published? I'm not sure it is published on our website, but we would be happy to provide that to the committee.
Representative Pepin?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Bogie, when you're talking about the investment policies, we're expanding the investment authority, so even though it has policies now, you're expanding it. So will it talk about the philosophy of investing, or, I mean, it's going to have to expand, so I'm just wondering what the intention is there.
Ms. Bogie.
Mr. Chair and committee members, our current policy states that we can invest in those things under MS... under the current statute. And so now, since these will be included in that statute, it will continue to say we can invest under that. In addition, we do have some strategy in our policy as well. For instance, our policy lays out a number of principles. The first one I mentioned was protect the principal. That's listed first because it's the most important part of our investment policy. Other parts of the policy says that we'll diversify. Talk about duration, things like that are very investment-oriented in terms of assuring that we have an investment portfolio that minimizes risk to the council.
Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess Representative Nelson. So why should we give this authority to an unelected board?
Chair and committee members, this is simply an investment tool. It gives us one more thing that we're able to invest in to be able to manage cash flows and investment income within the council. So it's not a tool that's really a political tool. It's very much an investment tool that private industry as well as the larger counties and cities are allowed to use this tool to manage their investments and their cash flows. So this is a risk management tool in my mind. It's very simply just something that we invest in to manage cash and hopefully gain some investment income.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, it's about allowing getting the best bang for our buck and making sure that the money that these people are managing, the Met Council, the cities, City of St. Paul and Minneapolis, the counties of Ramsey and Hennepin are using this, is so that the money they have, that they can make it go as far as possible and alleviate any risk that might be there in the market, so that they're judiciously using our taxpayer dollars.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bogie, just a question. How much at any given time, how much money does the Met Council have invested?
Ms. Bogie.
Anywhere and everywhere.
Mr. Chair and committee members, our short-term investment portfolio at the end of the calendar year was $129 million. Our long-term portfolio, $392 million. And then we also have $180 million invested with the State Board of Investment for our other post-employment benefit future liability.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Bogie. So, you're looking at
future liability.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Bogie. So, you're looking at $600-700 million, close to $750 million at one time. Very interesting. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any further questions. So, Representative Nelson, would you like to renew
my motion that House File 2319 as amended be sent to the referred to the General Register?
Okay. Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Oh. Okay. The motion prevails. The bill is referred.
Thank you.
PAMAR, which bill we're doing first.
House File 2755, the Corrections Bill, another in our long line of unsessioned bills. And Representative Paymar, I'll move that House File 2755 be placed on the General Register. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name, or please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2755 is the work of the Department of Corrections and myself, Representative Lesh, Representative Hillstrom, Representative Cornish, who spent some time with the DOC looking at a number of provisions and statutes and requesting that we delete some of them that are obsolete. We worked through those recommendations very carefully, but if you'd like, I can go through each section. I have Deputy Assistant Commissioner Carlson here. Sorry. But I can go through them, or you could... if you have specific questions.
Mr. Chair, our... Representative Paymar, my understanding is this bill was sent to us mistakenly. There's not a lot really that is our purview, so if it's just quickly, briefly do the bill, and if we have questions, if members have questions, I guess we'll go there. I see you have a testifier with you that can answer, I'm supposed to answer questions. So, yeah. Members, any questions of the bill? This is the unsessioned bill for the Department of Corrections, and Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like there are a couple sections that talk about the advisory boards. So I think that's probably why it got sent here. I don't know that it was a mistake when you're deleting the requirements of advisory boards. If there really isn't much that involves this committee, I would like to know, since this is an unsession bill, how much money does this, if this were to pass, would it save the state of Minnesota? And how many active boards, agencies, or commissions are repealed under this bill?
I'll let Assistant Commissioner Carlson answer the last question, but from my observation, I don't believe that you will see a major fiscal impact. It's simply removing statutes that are no longer relevant. Programs within the Department of Corrections have been shifted over to other programs over the years. We're hoping that what we're doing at the Department of Corrections is making the facilities run more efficiently and enhancing our programs to ensure that our staff is safe and that our programs are giving an opportunity for offenders to reintegrate back into society once they're released. But I'd ask Assistant Commissioner Carlson if she wants to speak.
Commissioner Carlson.
Directly.
Please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Facilities Division for the Department of Corrections. Related to the question about advisory boards, there is not an advisory board being repealed or deleted in this document. There is some information about annual reports for the Interstate Corrections Compact as it relates to that group, but there's not an advisory board being repealed.
Ms. Carlson, I think what we're talking about here is on page 118 about inmates serving on a board of directors, and I guess what is that board of directors that they're being removed from, or Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that clarification. So on page 1.18 through 1.21, we are deleting the ability for inmates to serve on a board of directors position in an executive kind of role. It used to be that we had a collaboration with a private business, and inmates served as on the board of directors for that business. That has not been in existence for many, many years. So thank you.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would greatly appreciate clarification on what the changes are that are being made to Minnesota statute to make us consistent with the interstate compact. And
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair. All right. There are several changes, and the interstate compact language starts on page 4. And there are no changes until page 18 and 19 for the adult supervision. So if you go to lines 18.36 through 19.8, the deletion of the language and then the addition of the language on page on 19.5 just makes it consistent with the existing compact. So I think it's self-explanatory. It's about the retaking of a parolee or probationer.
Representative Pugh.
And the hearings that happen.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2755 be placed on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill is referred. And Representative House File 3017, Representative Paymar. And I understand we have two amendments.
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair, and I have someone from DPS here.
I'll move that the bill recommends that House File 3017 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Yes, that's unfortunately true.
Representative Paymar, what's the A1 and the A2 amendment, are they your amendments?
Yes, they are, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment, if you would move that, this deals with collecting data on domestic abuse. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but years ago this was a requirement that all police officers had to collect data about their domestic abuse arrests or non-arrests and send them to the state. And the purpose of that was to find out how law enforcement was actually handling these cases so legislators and policymakers around the state could make more informed recommendations on these cases. This has not been done consistently for years, but when we were working on the unsessioned bill, we decided that it was important that the department look at how to collect that data again, and hence that's the amendment.
Representative Pepin.
And Ms. Magnuson from the Office of Justice Programs is here if you would have any more questions.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, did we pass this amendment already?
We haven't passed it yet, no.
The amendment seems like it's much more related to civil law and it's going there. Could we wait until this seems like it needs some vetting in that committee. Can we just skip this amendment and then put it on in civil law? It's about data collection.
Representative Pepin, the reason this we have to send it to civil law is because of this amendment. If we don't put this amendment on, I believe it would go right to the floor. So by us putting this amendment on here, that would send it to civil law. Otherwise, we can send it to the floor without the amendment, and then he could try and put it on the floor. I don't want that mess.
Okay.
So like the earlier conversation, let's put it on, and we'll send it there, and they can deal with it. So I'll move the A1 amendment. Any further questions? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The amendment's adopted. The next amendment I have is the A2 amendment, and this looks like it's technical.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There's on line on page 5, line 5.24, there is a statute that deals with trafficking that should be deleted, which is 609.322. That was a mistake when the bill was drafted to us, proposed to us.
Questions on the amendment? I'll move the A2 amendment. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Amendment
so approved. To the bill, you know, much like the Department of Corrections, we went through the DPS made a lot of recommendations. We didn't accept all of them. Some of them were too controversial. Some of the programs that are being deleted have been absorbed by the department or the Office of Justice Programs. Some of so it looks like we're getting rid of a lot of good stuff. In actuality, a lot of that good stuff is being handled by other agencies within the department. But we're happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Representative Kepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pugh, I just want to clarify the same question I had for the other bill. Does this bill save the state any money, or does it repeal or eliminate any active state boards, agencies, commissions, task forces, etc.?
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I don't think it doesn't save money that I know of.
And the other part?
What was the other part?
Eliminate boards.
Does it eliminate any active boards that are currently meeting?
I don't believe so. Mr. Chair, I don't believe so.
And I see Ms. Magnuson shaking her head no. So, Representative Pugh, your question was on the First Amendment?
Yeah, and I don't.
And that's what I just wanted to verify that.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, any members, anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 3017 be re-referred as amended. Thank you. To be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Mm-hmm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill's re-referred. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. And members, the bills that we didn't get to today, just the one bill. Oh, that wonderful bill. the bill we didn't get today will be progressed to Wednesday night. And I know there's people still working on it. And if we had had time, we'll accept amendments up until 6 o'clock tomorrow. Tonight. 6 o'clock tonight. And I haven't seen any come through, but I would, if you have them, please bring them forward. I know there's one that's being worked on, but if any members have amendments, please bring them forward so we can work on them. I've been trying to work with the opponents of the bill and the governor's staff to try and come to a kumbaya on this, and so hopefully we can get that by tomorrow night. So the rulemaking bill. So with that, members, we have minutes. We have three sets of minutes here. Representative Freiberg.
I'll move the minutes of the March 18th, March 19th, and March 21st meetings. I'll move the minutes of the March 18th, 2014.
All in favor of approving the minutes of March 18th as printed, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
I'll move the minutes of the March 19th meeting.
All those in favor of the minutes of approving the minutes of March 19th as printed, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The minutes are approved.
I'll move the minutes of the March 21st meeting.
All those in favor of the March 21st minutes as printed, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. And with that, members, we're adjourned.